is the most astounding fact you can share with us about the universe?
The most astounding fact.
The most astounding fact.
Is the knowledge that the atoms that comprise life on Earth, the atoms that make up the human body, are traceable to the crucibles that cooked light elements into heavy elements in their core under extreme temperatures and pressures. These stars, the high mass ones among them, went unstable in their later years. They collapsed and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy. Guts made of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the fundamental ingredients of life itself. These ingredients become part of gas clouds that condense, collapse, form the next generation of solar systems, stars with orbiting planets. And those planets now have the ingredients for life itself. So that when I look up at the night sky, and I know that, yes, we are part of this universe, we are in this universe, but perhaps more important than both of those facts is that the universe is in us. When I reflect on that fact, I look up. Many people feel small because they're small and the universe is big, but I feel big because my atoms came from those stars. There's a level of connectivity. That's really what you want in life. You want to feel connected. You want to feel relevant. You want to feel like you're a participant in the goings-on of activities and events around you. That's precisely what we are, just by being alive.
Up until the 20th century, the prevailing viewpoint among both philosophers and scientists was that the universe is eternal, that matter and energy have always existed, that the universe never began to exist, and therefore it seemed there was no need for a creator of the universe. That worldview crumbled under the impact of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity and its application in 1917 to the questions of cosmology. What Einstein's theory predicted was that the universe cannot be a static, eternal, in effect timeless entity. Rather, the universe is either going to be in a state of a cosmic expansion or collapse. And in either case, this cannot be extrapolated to past infinity. It predicted that the universe, indeed time and space themselves, must have had a beginning at some point in the finite past. During the 1920s, observational astronomy began to uncover evidence for these purely theoretical predictions that Albert Einstein's theory had made. So that today the prevailing view among contemporary cosmologists and astrophysicists is that the universe is not in fact infinite in the past, but that time and space, matter and energy are finite and came into being at some point a finite time ago. And I think this is the most powerful evidence ever to come out of science for the existence of a transcendent cause of the universe which brought the universe into being.
Right, it is, of course, my first 4 seconds of audio. I was looking to see if I had the mic on. So it's on now. It is, I don't even know what it is, April 9th, 2015. We're here in the Sullivan Studios, which is actually my garage, with, I think just like last time, we had our screens down, keep the bugs out. With me tonight is Paul Adams, who is a 20-year Air Force veteran. He went to grad school for philosophy, worked in IT, was in education, and is the local philosopher, the local guru. He actually lives on top of a hill, and we all go to his house, and he sits there cross-legged, and we ask him deep questions about the fundamentals existence of the universe, which is kind of why I start off with those two quotes, because we saw the complete polar opposite, I guess, theories of the existence of the universe. One is that things came into being. Everything around us is fundamentally particles, and that's it. And then, of course, the other side says, no, we're spiritual beings, that everything was created for a reason, created by a creator. And I think tonight, over the next 45 minutes to an hour, we're actually going to definitively come up with the answer if there is a God. Maybe not.
It'll be settled.
Okay. Am I working, or is that, what do you call that? My hopes too high that we'll be able to finish that over a couple beers?
No, three beers maybe.
All right. So where do you start? Where do you start with something like this? And of course, from my standpoint, I think I was telling you this when I was asking you if you wanted to come over for the podcast, is that, you know, 20 years ago, I thought I had it figured out. Maybe when I was, you know, let's see, 20 years ago, I'd be in my 20s, a little bit younger, in my teens. So I guess between my teens and my 20s, I thought I had it figured out. And then as I got older, into my 30s, and things change, you get married, you have kids, I guess more time to, well, not really time, but I just read more. And then everything I thought I had figured out was like a house of cards, and it just collapsed. And now I look outside at the stars, and I lay at bed at night and just contemplate where it all begins and where it all goes, and who knows. Yeah. So, well, I say who knows, but, you know, some people have what they consider a definitive answer, and that's good. But in order to kind of, I guess, guide the conversation tonight, I always read both sides. You know, I'll read, like we were talking about before we started the show, Carl Sagan all the way to Neil deGrasse Tyson or Sam Harris, because I think it's just important to get the full spectrum of, sure, of opinion. To bring you into the conversation, I was reading St. Thomas Aquinas. I was trying to read St. Thomas Aquinas.
Not easy.
No. And he had he has a very very famous five proofs of God's existence. And I believe he starts off with, well, you would know, you used to teach this, so you would know a little bit more about this than I do.
Yeah. But, you know, before we actually go there, mm-hmm, you know, you said something I think that's really important, Kevin. You said, where do you even start?
Oh, of course,
with the discussion about this topic, such as the existence of God. It's large, no question about it. And I think one possibility for a good starting point is to sort of talk about the playing field and the nature of beliefs. You know, a person can believe something to be true, but that does not make it true. I used to say to my students, saying it to be so does not make it so.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that? And so beliefs and truth are a funny thing. They really are. And so when it comes to large topics such as the existence of God, I would suggest that we can only have relative certainty, not absolute certainty. So let me give you an example of each. I am absolutely certain that my brother is not an only child.
Mm-hmm.
I am absolutely certain that I exist. Thinking of Rene Descartes, for example, mm-hmm, whose famous dictum, cogito ergo sum, which simply means I think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
That is undeniable. You see, in order for me to deny my existence, I have to exist prior to my existence in order
right,
to deny it, in which case I've cut off my intellectual nose despite my attitudinal face.
It's a paradox.
Indeed. So, so I would say that that absolute certainty only comes from logic. And so statements like, my brother's not an only child, I'm absolutely certain of that because it defines itself.
Mm-hmm.
It defies discussion and argument. To say that I exist is simply the case. Now, if we were talking about Buddhists and so forth, and we were to go down that path, then we'd have to talk about reality. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, on the Western side of the globe, when we talk about beliefs, there's absolute certainty and there's relative certainty. An example of relative certainty would probably be something along these lines. I am relatively certain that my wife loves me.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Now, here's the thing. I've been married for almost 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am not absolutely certain that she loves me in the way that I'm absolutely certain that I exist or that my brother's not an only child. That's not a logical certitude. It's an existential one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relative to the state of affairs in which I find myself, having been married for 34 years, having seen her commitment to me. Either she's a sociopath mm-hmm. or she really loves me.
Yep.
So, but the fact that I can assert my wife loves me, I can only assert relative to my circumstances and my perspective. So when it comes to the existence of God, I would suggest that we can only be relatively certain about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of a belief, in order for me to commit to a belief, all I need is about 51% certainty or more. So I'm 51% certain that the chair that I just sat in was going to hold me up before I put my weight in it, having mm-hmm. never sat in it before, having no prior experience with this chair. So having sat in this chair, now that I've sat in it, my certainty has increased by more than 51%. But in order for me to commit to the belief that this chair would hold my weight, I had to at least have 51% certainty or more and jump in bed with that belief by way of putting my weight in it.
Mm-hmm.
So to speak. So I think it's important that when we start out this discussion that we understand that the nature of beliefs are a sticky wicket. They're not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And beliefs come in two types, absolute and relative.
Okay. So that, wow, never really think of it in that sense. I think beliefs on the surface, especially when you talk about, let's just say the masses, on the surface is a cultural thing, a societal thing versus where they think that deep into it.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's when you, I don't even know what the word is I'd be looking for, but I guess it's when you reach that existential point in your life where you start contemplating what the meaning of belief is and,
sure.
and that you get into that level of it.
But I guess, you know, even though I'm a theist, I believe that there is a God.
Mm-hmm.
I am only relatively certain of that. And mm-hmm. I think any theist who's intellectually honest would have to maintain that.
Okay.
That they could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I could be wrong.
Right.
And I'm open to that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I want my beliefs to be true beliefs.
Right.
True in the sense that it corresponds to an actual state of affairs. It corresponds to the way things really are. I want my beliefs to actually fit reality.
Okay.
And that's very important to me. So I'm open to being wrong because
right.
I want to adjust where I need to.
Which is a very, it's a noble stance to have. And I think when people consider themselves in the right, take an atheist, a devout atheist. Does that even make sense? But you know what
sure.
I mean? Someone who,
yeah.
who says, you know, there is no God. To me, you would have to me. It makes more sense for that person to be an agnostic, to say, "Okay, is there a chance there is a God? Absolutely. How can you ever be certain to be that certain to say no, there is no God? I am an atheist."
Yeah.
I think you could use that term very specifically if you were to talk to a Muslim or a, but Muslims and Jews and Christians all have the same God. Am I correct by that?
The same assertion that there is but one God.
Okay, right.
Whether or not it's the same God is another discussion
okay.
altogether.
So you could talk to someone, a Hindi, and
mm-hmm. sure.
and or a Native American who believes in a mm-hmm. type of God, and then you can be an atheist towards that particular God.
Right.
If someone asked me, do I believe in the sun god Ra of ancient Egypt? No, I'm an atheist towards Ra. But if you asked me, am I 100% sure there is no Ra? I don't know. I mean, is it possible that the Egyptians
yeah.
are right? Yeah, maybe. I mean,
good. And that, I think, is an intellectually responsible response.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. Because it is possible that we are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It simply is, especially right. about things that are not logically certain in mm-hmm. the way that I explained, like a circle has no corners.
Right.
I'm logically certain of that.
Right.
And so forth and so on.
So with that, where did Aquinas kind of fall into this? I know he was a Christian, right? He was a philosopher.
Yes.
He was, okay.
A Catholic theologian mm-hmm. and an interesting character in many ways. But he was probably the most important mind that the Catholic Church has had in the past 1,000 years. I think it's safe to say that.
Was he a response from the Catholics to like Aristotle?
Yes, Aquinas actually followed Aristotle very closely.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, although Augustine lived some almost 900 years earlier than Aquinas, Aquinas was familiar with Augustine.
Okay.
But he did not follow Augustine as much as he did Aristotle
okay.
in terms of his philosophy and in terms of his proofs for the existence of God.
So. Okay. And when you read his proofs and you read his I guess his theories, his philosophical theories, you don't get a sense of these are Christian theories or these are, you could put them into
good.
Any, you know, any
good
puzzle. You could say this is a, you know, the theory, you could use it basically in any religion or anything. You know, there's people who just believe that God is whatever. And that's what I got from reading him is that he says, you know, take the, where's the first proof here? Take the, oh, the, a mover,
mm-hmm.
What is it? The, there's a term for it. Well, whatever is in motion has been put in motion by another.
Good.
So the universe has been, the fact that it is in motion means something had to put it in motion. And when you read him and the way he talks about that, he doesn't say, he says it in such a, is the term I'm looking for ubiquitous way, or
yeah, that's a good word.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's generic in
yes.
the sense that, the most we can get out of these five arguments from Aquinas mm-hmm. is that there is this thing, this entity, this being we call God,
mm-hmm.
whether or not it's a Christian God, whether or not it's a Jewish God or Islamic God, or perhaps the Trimurti, which is the threefold God of mm-hmm. Hinduism. Is another discussion altogether.
Now, did he see it as an entity or as, so let's say, again, we don't know, we know up to the very few seconds after the Big Bang, we just don't know what caused it, we don't know what it was, and we mm-hmm. don't know what came before it.
Mm-hmm.
I think your phone is actually...
Oh, thank you.
Oh, here you go.
Causing problems.
Oh, and it could be mine too, because mine's right there.
Voilà.
So we know up to the seconds after...
Uh-huh.
And some could say, and it's hard to even postulate what could cause that because it's almost like saying,
sure.
in your mind, picture nothing. Well, how do you picture nothing? Nothing is such a hard concept to understand because if you picture blank space, I mean, you're picturing something. You can't define nothing. I mean, there's a vacuum, but a vacuum is something. So
yeah,
whatever caused the nothing to become something, whether that's a being that we would say in the Christian faith, someone that's in our image, or I mean, that's in his image, or whatever it was that set that off, whatever it was that set off the Big Bang and the galaxy would be God because it is the reason why we're here.
Yeah. Philosophers and even Aquinas was careful about this. Nothing is actually more of a technical term, it's the absence of everything. Nothing has no properties.
Mm-hmm.
Zero. Nada.
Nothing, nil. Yeah.
It has no properties. And the principle that nothing comes from nothing is the underlying assumption under all of these arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, under every argument, or when we say argument, by the way, in philosophy, we mean it not to be, you know, fist clenching, yelling and screaming. We mean an intelligent discussion to try and persuade one to one side or another.
Right.
It's not necessarily a negative thing. So when one puts forth that the universe came from nothing, that begs a lot of questions, and that is, how did it come to? Why is it even here?
Right.
Why is there something rather than nothing?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to be. And then that raises a question that Aquinas gets into in the third argument, which we'll perhaps go to later on. But one that I think the question that it raises is so important that it, too, is one of the underlying assumptions of all five arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go there hopefully in a moment. But yeah, the first argument simply says that we observe that some things in the world are in motion. Whatever is in motion is put into motion by another object. That is in motion. This other object, in turn, was put into motion by still another object preceding it, and so forth.
Yeah.
And hence we have an infinite regress of objects that put objects into motion.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that's begged there is, what was the first mover?
Right.
What was the first object that kicked it all off?
Mm-hmm. But then isn't it a very common argument from the agnostic or atheist side to say, well, then what moved the mover? You know, I mean, we talked about that. So you have the supreme mover, but didn't something have to move him? Or
and the answer to that in accord with Aristotle is that he is the unmoved mover.
Okay.
So that's a classic response, and I think a responsible one. And by the way, let me just say, when I refer to God as a he, when I use the male pronoun,
I was just thinking the same thing.
I do not intend that God has a gender. Okay, he has a sexual gender.
Right.
I think there's really good reason to believe that God is neither male nor female.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really important. I use the male pronoun A, out of habit, B, because it's still a lingua franca, and C, because some people have a problem with me calling God a she.
Right.
I don't have a problem with that, because I think God, once again, is genderless, but nevertheless, that's a caveat I had to say.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, I was just thinking that, too, as I said it, because I think I said it. Yeah, but it's not a big deal. So, yeah, the mover, we go back to the Big Bang. Did someone move the mover? He's the ultimate, or he is the, what would you call it?
The unmoved mover. And that's not irrational to assert that. There is a being who himself or herself, itself, is an unmoved mover. That's not irrational. It's not hard to get your mind around. That we can comprehend such a being is another discussion.
Okay.
But that we can apprehend the construct of an unmoved mover is not so hard, I don't think.
Do you think that something of that nature, he, she, it, that can set off basically reality as we know it, can be a personal God? Or and that's a big question because I look at this all the time because, you know, when I'm laying down and contemplating everything, you have, I mean, and I have, I guess I have two caveats with this. Number one is you have the overwhelming size of the universe. Overwhelming. I mean, you can sort of look at the numbers and you can try to contemplate it that way, but there's just, it's not of our minds to even understand the size of the universe. For every grain of sand on every beach in the entire Earth, there's a galaxy. Or no, there's a star. So each of those, I mean, if you think about that, you grab a handful, I mean, just any beach and you say, that's a star on the entire world. So that just shows you how mind-bending it is. So then when you think about planets and then galaxies, I mean, so that's number one. The second part of that was, is the notion, have you ever heard the notion, and I read these things and then I don't, you know, I come by them real quick and I don't. So there's this notion of, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a puddle who wakes up and says, hey, I'm a puddle, and wow, this hole that I fit in fits perfectly. This is a great puddle. This this hole was made for me.
Okay.
But, you know, the hole was there first. The puddle came in there second and came into being. So we look at this universe and we say, wow, look at the size of this universe. It's massive. Time is extremely long. You know, just the idea of 13 point something billion years, however old the universe is. And we say, look at how special this place is just for me.
Yeah, there's an astrobiologist by the name of Gutierrez Guillermo. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I had that backward. Guillermo Gutierrez.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written a book entitled The Privileged Planet,
mm-hmm.
in which he argues that of all the possibilities of a life prohibiting universe, why is it that the Earth alone is a life permitting vessel or mm-hmm. vehicle mm-hmm. for life?
There's the question.
and through his studies and research, he argues that the mathematical probability of it
mm-hmm.
is off the charts,
mm-hmm.
absolutely off the charts. I don't remember the specific numbers. I should have brought the book with me. It's at home in my library if anybody is interested in it. It's a fascinating question, is why this universe this way? Why this hole for this puddle?
Or this Earth for this short amount of time? Humans have only been on it for a short amount of time in really an eggshell thin section of the Earth. We can't be too high. We can't be too low. We have to be on this thin eggshell mm-hmm. at the right time to be alive.
Right. Yeah, and that's a fascinating question. And in fact, that actually speaks to another argument that Aquinas put forth, and that is known as trying to be brief here. It's the fifth argument he puts forth says this: we observe in nature that inanimate and non-intelligent objects act toward the best possible purpose, even though these objects are not aware of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
There's your puddle in
right,
the hole.
Right.
It is clear that these objects do not achieve their purpose by sheer chance, but rather according to a plan. Any inanimate or non-intelligent object, your puddle in the hole,
mm-hmm.
that acts toward a purpose, though, must be guided by a being that possesses knowledge and intelligence, just as an arrow is directed by an archer.
One was that?
That's the fifth argument.
Okay.
And that's known as, here's a big word, the teleological mm-hmm, argument. Mm-hmm. Telos
yep.
is a Greek word for, it means a lot, but basically it means target, goal, purpose, end, as in the end, goal. The teleological argument speaks about everything having its own end or purpose or design or intelligence built into it that is moving in one direction. And the universe seems to be that kind of thing that has intelligence built into it. Why do we have just the right amount of iron in the core of the Earth so that we have just the right amount of gravity so that we have a life-permitting world? Why is that?
Wouldn't the answer be because we have a life-permitting world? If you look at it from the I am a puddle, this place is perfect for me. Without the hole, there'd be no puddle. So as a person who contemplates, you know, this Earth is such a rare place for us to exist, couldn't it be just the fact that we exist makes us be able to say, yes, this is a rare place for it to exist?
So you're saying that let me make sure I'm standing you right. Are you suggesting that that we are projecting some sort of special
yes.
purpose
mm-hmm.
on the universe?
Mm-hmm. Like the puddle who projects a special purpose to the perfectly fitting hole.
Yeah, and that's actually a good argument that I've read about in the past, and I think it has some merit.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. But the burden, I think, is on the person who presents that as mm-hmm. an argument, that we're projecting this unique design on the universe. The burden is on them to demonstrate how that is.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're in the realm of psychology,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not convinced. I got an attitude about psychology. I admit it. I'm a philosopher, but I'm not convinced that psychology is equipped to provide the kind of warrant to uphold that assertion in the way that philosophy and science can.
Psychology is very, yeah.
It's squishy.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's and you're looking squishy. At the human condition. And the human condition is pliable. It's not... it's not concrete.
It is. Yeah, it's relative.
Yeah, it absolutely is relative. I'm working in medicine. Believe me, I know it's relative. But yeah, that's...
So, you know, going back to the, if I could, going back to the argument from intelligent design,
mm-hmm.
It looks as if the universe was painted by an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems reasonable to conclude that all of this design could not have come about through random processes.
Mm-hmm.
It seems more reasonable to suggest that there's some intelligence underneath it all. Consider Mount Rushmore. Now, is it possible that the wind and time and chance and the rain and all the other weather elements could have formed those faces mm-hmm. and on that location in our lifetime so that we can say, look there and say, wow, look what nature has done.
Is it possible?
It's
yeah, I guess it is.
Mathematically
yeah.
possible yeah, yeah. and therefore logically not unreasonable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that it takes more faith to commit to that kind of belief than to commit to a belief that probably Mount Rushmore was formed and fashioned by some kind of intelligent being or beings
mm-hmm.
in this case. Likewise, the universe seems to have a lot of things in place that suggest there's a lot of design going on so that we have this thing we call a life-permitting universe.
Mm-hmm.
Why us? Why us?
Do you... And okay, so if you had a perfect being which designed the entire universe, not just the Earth, I mean, who knows? There could be other Earths out there that are just as perfectly designed, and there's a being that designed them. I mean, we just don't know that. Why would there be then errors, or what we perceive as
good.
Errors in the design?
Good.
You know, 99% of species mm-hmm. that ever lived on this planet are gone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Either by meteors or their own flaws.
Sure.
So where does, and I guess the easy explanation, or not an easy, but the, I guess I could say that the easiest explanation would be, well, who are we to try to contemplate the meaning behind why God would set this into motion? I mean, why, or, you know, who are we to say, why are the dinosaurs dead? Or it's not our plan. It was his plan. But it's still begs to question, especially from the agnostic point of view, to say, well, if this is supposed to be perfect, why is there so much imperfection?
The argument has never been that because there's design in the universe that it's therefore perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That's a misnomer.
Okay.
And that's unfortunate that so much of that has been argued. I would never maintain that because there is the appearance of design,
mm-hmm.
and it's more reasonable to believe in design and intelligence in the universe, that therefore it's optimal, in an optimum situation. I would never suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, good night. All I have to do is read the front page of any newspaper
sure,
in
yeah.
any city and recognize the imperfections.
Mm-hmm.
But that begs another discussion, too, and that's all related here, and that is, what do we do about evil, suffering, and pain in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
We not only have species that are missing, we have a lot of broken hearts out there.
Sure.
Because of life tragedies. So that's probably the most difficult question for every world religion when it comes to the existence of God. David Hume, echoing Epicurus of the first century, says this: is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent.
Mm-hmm.
Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil? How do we account for this thing we call evil?
Right.
Or pain and suffering, gratuitous, unnecessary shooting of innocent people as they're running away from you, and you being a police officer should know better, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So to speak to one current event, for example.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile our belief in God, a belief in God, with that kind of nonsense?
Right.
That is a perennial question and one that is not easily answered. But I believe that the theist can offer a viable answer that is worthy of consideration.
Mm-hmm.
May I?
Sure. Hey.
Okay. The atheist would argue in relation to evil that God is perfectly good and omnipotent. A perfectly good being always eliminates evil as far as it can, so says the theist. I'm sorry, I said atheist.
Mm-hmm.
There are no limits to what an omnipotent being can do. But evil exists. Therefore, God does not exist. That's one line of reasoning.
Right. And that actually falls onto, I believe, one of Aquinas's...
The fourth argument.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
It does. Yeah, which we did not cover.
Right. Gradation,
oops.
Right?
Yes, yeah. Gradation, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That things have a degree mm-hmm. of perfection built into them, but are not themselves perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fourth argument. How do we account for that degree of perfection? So there's the fourth argument.
All right.
So a possible response to the atheist who would assert that God does not exist because evil does exist, that it is inconsistent to hold, on the one hand, that God is loving, God is good, God is able, and evil exists. It is inconsistent. I, as a theist, openly admit that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also argue that inconsistency is not the same as irrationality. It's not irrational for me to assert that evil exists and a good, loving God exists. That's not irrational. How those go together is the burden on me to try and put forth. In fact, the atheist must show that the theist should accept these basic assumptions. Number one, that a perfectly good being always eliminates evil as far as it can, and that there are no limits to what an omnipotent being can do.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it is logically possible that God has morally sufficient reasons, unbeknownst to us, for permitting all the evils that there are in this world. I'm going to say that again. That, to me, is very important. It is logically possible. I didn't say psychologically appealing. I didn't say existentially viable. I said it's logically possible that God has morally sufficient reasons, unbeknownst to me, for permitting all the evils that there are. Now, the word permitting there is very important. I did not say perform all the evils that there are. He permitted it. Mm-hmm. In the same way that a parent permits the child sufficient freedom to go ahead and make the mistakes so that that child can learn, for example. So all those words in that statement that I repeated are very important.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, is it logically possible that God could create free creatures who only do what he wants? So we have the discussion around free will we have to have.
Right.
Other arguments for God's existence, others that we've mentioned here, and there are more than we've mentioned here, but the teleological argument, the cosmological argument, which we didn't get to, is evidence that God does exist, and it's not incompatible with the existence of evil. So even though evil may be a defeater for the existence of God in the argument for God, if we only look at evil, it's not a defeater for the overall cumulative arguments that there are for the existence of God. So while I may struggle with evil, and I may just throw up my hand and say, I don't know what to do,
mm-hmm.
but I will not conclude that God does not exist because there's other reasons to believe that he does.
Okay.
So.
Do you think there's... So we've been talking about a creator, intelligent design, and then we come on to... And I try not to tread into this area, especially, I mean, some people might, but I think it causes more arguments than that. But then you go into the religious aspect of it.
Okay.
All the world's religions from now into the history of world religions, all the way back to, I don't even know what Saturnalia, Mithra, Ra.
Uh-huh.
So you go all the way back. Those, do you think those are human beings' attempt at answering and finding the true nature of whatever a creator would be? And if so, how do we know who is right? Take the big religions nowadays. There's what we can say off the top of my head. I mean, there's a lot out there, but we can do five. We can say Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hindu, and Buddhist, but that's not really a religion, technically.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, no question. One of the leading world religion experts, Christian Smith,
said it was religion.
It is indeed a religion. Yeah.
So if you were separated from all those, and someone said, "Quick, pick a religion," mm-hmm. you got a 20% chance of yeah. finding the right one.
Sure.
And that's just today. And then again, you go through all the religions throughout the world. I mean, I don't know what the the list of names for God and what he stood for over the years is at least 102. I mean, you can even go back to the Greeks who had multiple gods, and there's more than are actually documented because of any sort of tribal group has their own gods. The mm-hmm. sun was a god for a while.
Sure.
So when you have the argument of a creator, I guess is basically what I'm getting to. Is religion the response to that, or do you think it's, I guess,
good
it's
question.
An open-ended question?
It's large.
Yeah.
I did my thesis in grad school on religious pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the leading proponents of a view that suggests that everything kind of fits into one bucket,
mm-hmm.
Who's since passed about 3 years ago now, is John Hick. He's mm-hmm. out of the University of Birmingham in England, and prolific author in the area of religious pluralism, and has leveled some wonderful arguments for a religiously pluralistic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, how do we know? I can only answer for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I have certain criteria that I apply to my most deepest commitments and beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And apply to my worldview. And that is that my beliefs must, first of all, be logically consistent.
Mm-hmm.
They can't be nonsense in my head. I can't believe that something exists and something doesn't exist simultaneously. That's sheer nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Aristotle taught us the basic laws of logic, one of which is the law of non-contradiction. A thing cannot be and not be in the same sense in the same way. So a ball cannot be both red all over and green all over simultaneously.
Okay.
Yeah, I know you can paint it over and over, but you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
A ball cannot be both round and square simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so my beliefs must first and foremost be logically consistent. Secondly, my beliefs must be empirically adequate. That is, they must fit the facts as I understand them
mm-hmm.
and as the larger community understands them. Third, my beliefs must be existentially viable. I must be able to live consistently with my beliefs. Otherwise, I will implode psychologically. They have to make sense in my head, logically consistent. They have to make sense in my world, empirically adequate,
mm-hmm.
and they have to make sense in my life, existentially viable. And when I apply that criteria over the world religions, the only world religion that fits that criteria for me
right.
is Christianity.
Okay.
That's the way I understand it. Now, I've looked at a lot of other world religions. I've seriously considered Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
I even considered, are you sitting down? Yes, you are. Scientology.
Okay.
So for you jazz guys out there or jazz folks, I got a letter from Chick Corea one time.
Oh,
so
really?
If you're hip to him.
Wow,
so,
yeah.
And on and on. Of course, I'm a former jazz musician, but nevertheless. So I've considered a lot of other things,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, the thing that makes sense in my head, that makes sense in my life, that makes sense in my world is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I can know. And when I apply that criteria across the board, then Christianity makes the most sense. And of course, that's the way we come up with most of our beliefs is we all have a certain criteria that we apply to it. A lot of people end up just thinking with their hearts and feeling with their heads,
mm-hmm.
and they really don't have any criteria. It's just a subjective response to life. It's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to all of life, and what they end up with is today they may believe in Sun Ra, you know, the Egyptian god. Tomorrow they might believe in Rastafarianism, and the next day they may be a Baha'i.
Okay,
you know, and so forth and so on. But for me, I can apply those criterion and consistently across the board, and Christianity is the one that makes the most sense for me.
Okay,
so I would encourage people who ask that question to come up with methodology and criteria that they wish to apply, and then seek to apply it to the world religions and see which makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say you have to read all the way through the Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, you know, and the Vedas.
Yeah.
You don't have to read all through the you know, the Buddhist scriptures, the Pali Sutras, and so forth. I mean, good grief.
Right.
You know.
So in essence, I feel like I'm getting from you that the path to righteousness is through, I guess it's subjective versus objective. It's if you're, well, you put an objective spin on it by saying you have criteria and everything. But the Hindu family that lives in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. who is praying, you know, to, I don't know, what's one of the, their...
Vishnu,
okay. He's the elephant one, right?
No, that's Ganesan.
Oh, okay. So they're playing a Vishnu. We'll go that one. I can pronounce it. That their child lives through the night. Bad fever. Prays. They pray through the night that their child lives. Their child dies. So they're, you know, as a parent, I couldn't even imagine, right? It just tears at their heart. Yeah. If someone from Islam or Christianity or Judaism were to look at that family and say, strictly within these bounds, that family wasn't praying to the right God, so no, it was falling on deaf ears. Right, but yeah. I'm saying that people can apply this to it.
Oh, indeed they have.
mm-hmm. And so the prayers fall on deaf ears. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but the suffering that the parents had to go through to a child who is deemed to... and it's hard for me to. I only come from the Judeo-Christian background growing mm-hmm. up, so I only know of heaven and hell and all that. So under that, the child would go to hell, and the parents, of course, would go to hell because they didn't accept Jesus. And all this was put into motion by mm-hmm. an omniscient God that said, "I'm going to put you here in this area that doesn't have Christianity, and put this suffering onto you." And I think that was one of the arguments that kind of pushed me more towards, and I say, mm-hmm. I don't like to define who I am. There's a lot of, and I think everyone has to go through this, between the ages of like, we can cut out adolescence because that's just something else. But when you become an early adult until you move on to your middle age, For some people, I guess I should say, it can be a very chaotic time because not only do you have to, if you get married, you have to start thinking about someone else. If you have kids, you really have to start thinking about someone else. Mm-hmm. But you also have to start thinking about, or maybe you don't, but I found that I had to start thinking about, okay, what does all this mean in the end? Where does this take me? What is the end goal? Is it, it's not the 401k. It's not my refrigerator, you know, is programmable or that I have granite countertop. None of that. None of that matters.
Right.
What matters is what my relationship with my family and then what happens. Where does this all go? And it was in accepting, the inevitable, that this here will end. I accepted that, and I accepted all the things that I would ponder at night. I accepted that the universe is so big and that we're so small in comparison, and really our universe takes place between our ears, especially, you know, it only can, because this is where we live. These are our lives. All the little things are just nonsense. It was when I just kind of came to that conclusion that I felt more peace than I ever did before. And it was like,
interesting,
you know, I can, if I died tomorrow, I would be upset that that, you know, I don't get to see my kids grow up or sure. be around here.
Your granite countertops didn't get sealed.
Yeah. I could care less about my granite countertops, but I'm not afraid of it. I don't,
good.
It doesn't bother me anymore. I mean, if I go, I go. I mean, there's no, everyone does it. Everyone crosses over, and who knows what's on the other side. Some say they know,
well, there's only four options.
what's that? The nothing.
Right. Annihilation.
Hell. Or is that an option?
Well, I don't like to think in those terms necessarily, but mm-hmm. resurrection, which is the Christian mm-hmm. and Judeo-Christian stance.
Right.
Research in Judaism is very scant in that area. Daniel chapter 12 is probably the most explicit text about the afterlife for Judaism, just
okay.
FYI. But nevertheless, it has it. So resurrection, mm-hmm. Judeo-Christian, and also Islam. Annihilation, poof, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Food for worms, to quote Nietzsche.
Right.
Reincarnation. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
Reincarnation,
okay.
also known as transmigration, but they're not the same depending on if you're Buddhist or Hindu. Okay, Hindus believe in transmigration, and Buddhists believe in reincarnation. They are not the same.
Okay.
We can have that discussion someday.
It's yeah.
fascinating.
Okay.
It's very complicated.
I should be taking notes.
For me, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it's reincarnation, resurrection, annihilation, and the fourth option is I don't give a damn.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the hand. Or in today's parlance, whatever.
Right, right.
You know, people, and that's where a lot of people are at with that. They just don't give a rip. But let me offer this. John Calvin had this understanding among many that he believed that in every human being is what he called the sensus divinitatis, also known as the seed of divinity. And by that, he meant that every human being has a piece of the divine in them. And today, we call it the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
In Genesis chapter 2, when God made man and woman, we have the image of God. Okay? So human beings, of all biological beings, are special in that regard. And that seed of divinity, that sensus divinitatis, that image of God, is what allows us to be in touch with the bigger picture, that there's something more to sealed granite countertops.
Mm-hmm.
There's something more to life than just my 401k.
There's so many people out there that don't either see that or just they
but
never
But why do we even
it?
Have that?
Yeah.
Why,
yeah, okay, I understand what you're saying.
That?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we have that because there's something in us that gives us that.
Mm-hmm.
It's thinking of Pascal, Blaise Pascal, 17th century mathematician and philosopher and Catholic theologian, died at 39 years old. But mm-hmm. nevertheless, he said there's a vacuum in our heart. There's mm-hmm. an empty space. And only God can fill that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's put there by God so that he alone can fill that. And so I would suggest that the reason you and I or any of us can even think about the big picture and the greater questions is because we have that capacity. We have a faculty built within us that allows us to make that kind of spiritual connection.
Okay.
So that's a suggestion.
Mm-hmm. And I once heard someone talk about life and every being as a spark thrown from a fire, from a great fire. And I never understood what that meant. I never understood it. And then you're going to think this is crazy. I I was watching The Sopranos, and there was an episode where one of the guys in the hospital or something, and he says... He's talking about looking out the window and seeing two tornadoes, and that anyone who looks across the field and sees two tornadoes says there's two tornadoes there. They're two separate things. They're of their own existence, and they're doing whatever those tornadoes do. But in essence, you're just seeing one. You're seeing the wind. You're seeing the air just take on two forms, but they're connected. They're absolutely connected. That first tornado dies. That second tornado, something's going to happen to it. Two tornadoes in a field are just because there's dust and dirt in them. You can see them, mm-hmm. but it's all still the same thing. Now, when you start applying that to, you can apply that theory to anything. You can apply that theory to you and I sitting here. And this, I think we're going more towards the Buddhist side of things though, but I always found this fascinating. You see a squirrel climb a tree, where our first inclination is to say, oh, look, a squirrel is climbing a tree. A Buddhist inclination is to really think nothing.
Nothing's climbing the tree for the Buddhist.
Right, exactly. Because it's all one.
It's all one. It's all nothing.
And all that squirrel is, and all that you and I are, in essence, is a conglomeration of proteins, atoms. Let's just bring it down to atoms, which are mostly empty
going back
space.
To Neil deGrasse. Mm-hmm.
Take away, we see each other because we have these eyes that can see the certain spectrum of light. So we have depth perception, and we have, so now we have this perception of whatever reality is. But really, when you break it down, we only see each other, and we're only experiencing all this because of the state that all this matter is taking at this time.
Right, but where the Christian and the Judeo-Christian and even the Islamic worldview would radically differ from the Buddhist worldview in that analogy is this. For the Buddhist, there is no subject-object distinction. There's the one who looks on the tornadoes, and then there are the tornadoes. Mm-hmm. For the Buddhists, there is no distinction.
Right.
They are a monistic worldview. Monos meaning one. Mm-hmm. Everything is one, and one is everything.
Right.
I am the tornado. The tornado is I. Tatvam usi. Trying to remember my Hindi. Tatvam. This is that. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Atman is Brahman, is a Hindu saying. They too have a monistic worldview that all that is God, and God is all that is. So they don't have a distinction between the subject and the object. whereas the Western side of the world and the Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, do maintain a distinction between the creator and the created, between the tornado and the wind that it produces. You see, the wind is not the tornado.
Right.
But the tornado produces the wind. And that I'm able to make that distinction is because I have these constructs built into my head that allow me to see that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And Kant, of course, was a master at bringing out that understanding about the way the human mind works. We have the ability to distinguish between subject and object. We have the ability to distinguish between lover and the loved.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's where Buddhism and Hinduism, carried to its logical conclusion, fails us, is we at the end of the day, we lose love.
Mm-hmm.
Because without a subject-object distinction, a lover and the loved, there is no possibility of love.
And that always threw me off with them, because they say in order to have love, you have to have hate. And to get rid of hate, you have to get rid of love. And I guess that makes sense. And that state of perfect nirvana would be not feeling either. And I understand that.
Losing all desire. But there's a dualistic mindset underneath all that. And that is desire exists.
Mm-hmm,
and it's something you got to lose.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, so you have at least two objects here,
two
metaphysical distinctions or metaphysical categories, even in Buddhism, but they don't admit that. So anyway,
we've been going on for an hour, believe it or not.
Have we really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so we have a lot. Basically, we failed the audience in that we didn't come up with the definitive proof that there is a God. So I apologize. We'll take another crack at this. No, but I thought this was really good. I think we'll have fun. Have you come back on, definitely, and we can talk about some of those other things. Absolutely. So with that, we do our... I always try to look for my closing song. Here it is. So this was the Wait What If podcast. We are on waitwhatif.podbean.com, which again, I don't know why I always say that, because if you're listening to this, you obviously know where to find us. If you can, tell people to listen to us. Point us in the right direction. Say, hey, check out these guys, Wait What If podcast. Listen to us on iTunes. You just look up Wait What If. Send us an email. It is waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. @yahoo.com. And I have a Twitter account, WWI podcast. I haven't tweeted anything yet. I used to have a Twitter account. I just watch what people say. Twitter is fantastic for if there's an award ceremony on, like the Oscars. I pull it up and I just see whatever, because the commentary is hysterical. That's the only reason why I watch stuff anymore.
Imagine what 140 characters can say.
Yeah, it's the only reason why I watch stuff. Is I would never watch the Oscars, never, or the Golden Globes, but now I just throw on Twitter and it just makes me laugh. It's a great way of watching it.
That's good.
So yeah, WWI or at WWI Podcast is our Twitter account. If I start seeing people subscribe to it, then I'll start tweeting stuff. That's it. We thank Paul, Paul Adams, and we hopefully will have him on again. And that's it for this week.